Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. We come to you 7 days each week with interesting stories from around the world. And we always speak slowly and use words that are easy to understand. Today we have two stories for you. The first one involves Cambodia, Australia, and people seeking asylum. Then some news from the world of science. Experts say that something very small that often serves as food for sea animals has a much more important purpose than previously known. So let's get ready to listen and learn. Here is part one. 4 asylum seekers arrived in Cambodia last week. They are the first asylum seekers from an Australian-operated camp on the Pacific island nation of Nauru. The island nation has been holding them for the Australian government. The refugees were denied permission to settle in Australia. Under a secretive deal, Australia agreed to pay Cambodia $32 million for accepting the refugees. Mario Ritter has more.
The details of the deal were kept in secret. Even the arrival of the 4 asylum seekers in Phnom Penh was kept out of sight of reporters. The 4 individuals left the city's airport in a vehicle whose windows were covered up. The refugees are an Iranian man and his wife, a second man, also from Iran, and an ethnic Rohingya man from Myanmar. They were taken to a house in Phnom Penh, where they will live for the next year. Under the deal, Australia will pay all resettlement costs for a year. Those refugees who accept will receive thousands of dollars in payments, language and skills training, and health care. The deal has been strongly criticized both in Australia and overseas. Phil Robertson is the Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division. He says Cambodia is a poor choice for refugee resettlement because of its recent treatment of refugees from Vietnam and China.
Cambodia clearly has no will or capacity to integrate refugees permanently into Cambodian society. These 4 refugees are essentially human guinea pigs in an Australian experiment that ignores the fact that Cambodia has not integrated other refugees and has already sent Montagnards and Uyghur asylum seekers back into harm's way in Vietnam and China.
He warns that the deal between Australia and Cambodia will likely harm refugee rights across Southeast Asia. An Australian Immigration Department press officer who traveled to Cambodia with the 4 individuals refused to speak to reporters in Phnom Penh. The Australian government is paying the International Organization for Migration, the IOM, to look after the refugees. Given the sensitive issue, is the IOM concerned about its image? Joe Lowry works for the group.
And we genuinely believe that this is the best option for these people at the moment. They're not going to get to Australia, so it's the only choice they have is stay on Nauru or come to Cambodia.
Australia hopes their experience will persuade some of the hundreds still on Nauru to consider giving up on their dream of living in Australia. In a video in April, Australia's Immigration Minister Peter Dutton told the detainees their choices were limited to remaining on Nauru for another 10 years or moving to Cambodia.
I want to make it very clear to all refugees and transferees in Nauru that you will not, under any circumstances, be settling in Australia. This is not an option that the Australian government will ever present to you. Cambodia provides you with a chance to start afresh, a chance to begin a new life. This is your only long-term settlement option.
More than 600 refugees and asylum seekers are thought to be living in Nauru. Hundreds more are in detention on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island under an agreement with Australia. Most are believed to be from South Asia or the Middle East. The proposed resettlement deal was the subject of months of secret negotiations. It has received criticism from rights organizations, religious groups, and opposition politicians in both countries. Rights groups say Mr. Dutton's description of Cambodia as a land of safety, security, and opportunity is untrue. His comments conflict with the Australian government's own advice to Australians thinking of visiting the country. Some Cambodians also are unhappy. Their homeland has high levels of corruption, poor education and health care systems, and no social programs to help the very poor. The Cambodians cannot understand why foreign nationals will get money and help that are unavailable to them and other citizens. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. For years, most people thought of small organisms called plankton as food for whales and other large sea animals. But a four-year-long study discovered that plankton are a major supplier of oxygen on our planet. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Plankton are a group of different ocean creatures, algae, bacteria, and other organisms. They live close to the water's surface in oceans, seas, and lakes. Plankton cannot be seen without a microscope, but they are the main source of food for larger animals like whales. Recently, 200 scientists from 45 countries took turns researching plankton on a two-mast schooner. The boat set sail in September 2009. It visited 210 areas. The scientists collected 35,000 samples of plankton. The researchers followed the lives of plankton, examined their genetic material, and watched their movements. A French nonprofit group called Tara Expeditions launched the project known as Tara Oceans. Chris Bowler was the project's scientific coordinator. He says the researchers found that plankton are very important to the health of our planet.
Generating the oxygen we breathe, removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and generally maintaining this Earth in a state that is habitable for us human beings.
Mr. Bowler says almost half of the oxygen we breathe comes from very small algae called diatoms. These plants live in the part of the water where the sun reaches.
That basically means every fifth time that you breathe, you're breathing oxygen, which we can directly trace back to diatoms. So they're sort of as important as the tropical rainforests in terms of their global contribution.
Romain Troublet is the executive director of Tara Oceans. He believes the study shows that the ocean greatly affects the Earth's climate.
We believe that the ocean is also a main driver of the climate change, a main mitigator, in the way that the ocean and the life in the ocean is storing carbon dioxide, storing heat, and this machinery works because the ocean is in good health.
Different groups of researchers studied different things. One group identified more than 40 million plankton genes, formerly unknown to scientists. The collected information will be used to identify which of the plankton have little or no trouble reacting to changing water conditions. Results of the study appeared in the online scientific journal Science. The publication says many experts will be examining the study. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
This is VOA, the Voice of America in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. For the past 15 years, experts on obesity have gathered in Plymouth, England to attend a conference. It is estimated that more than half the city's adults are overweight or obese. The rest of Britain is not doing much better. But what is happening in the UK is also happening in the US and other Western countries, as well as in a growing number of developing nations. VOA's Joe DiCapua talked with the expert who chaired the conference, called the Plymouth Symposium on Obesity, Diabetes, and Metabolic Syndrome. Jonathan Pinkney is a professor of endocrinology and diabetes at Plymouth University. Professor Pinkney said obesity is a long-term problem that is very difficult to solve. He said no one health issue has more impact on human health than obesity. Professor Pinkney called obesity a complex issue involving more than what a person eats.
I personally feel that this is such a wide field. There's so many issues. There's politics, there's biology, and there's the food industry. There's everything you could imagine. So I think it's right to talk about everything under one umbrella.
Mr. Pinkney says obesity can interfere and impair the ability to have a normal life. Mr. Pinkney warns that even people who are not considered obese can still be at risk. He said many people eat the wrong foods and do not get enough physical activity. People have been getting heavier and heavier slowly over time, he said, and that's a problem.
That's the more important point for the health of the population. You know, all the diabetes and heart attacks and cancers and things. I mean, that's really caused by lower levels of weight gain.
The conference provided much information about the biology of the brain and appetite control. The professor said people know how to eat healthy, but this knowledge is often overtaken by marketing of the food industry. Advertisers show food on television and in print in a way that creates immediate desire. Professor Pinkney said these images can lead some people to eat unhealthy foods. The expert argued that the obesity epidemic must be stopped at its source, when eating habits begin. Children, he said, often learn poor eating habits from their parents. The professor suggests one way to improve the situation. He said children should be protected from advertising and marketing put out by the food industry. Besides marketing campaigns, the professor also blames refined carbohydrates and sugars for much of the obesity epidemic. Refining is a process that removes fiber, nutrients, and other items contained within the food in its natural state. Refining also concentrates sugars and can cause our blood sugar levels to change more rapidly than normal. Without complex fiber, these foods do not satisfy a person's hunger for long. So, people eat their next meal sooner than normal. I'm Ana Mateo.
¶¶
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The world's first satellite was called Sputnik 1. Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war, and the Soviet Union had reached outer space first. The technology that launched Sputnik probably began in the late 19th century. A Russian teacher of that time, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, decided that a rocket engine could provide power for a space vehicle. In the early 1900s, another teacher, American Robert Goddard, tested the idea. He experimented with small rockets to see how high and how far they could travel. In 1923, a Romanian student in Germany, Hermann Oberth, showed how a spaceship might be built and launched to other planets. Rocket technology improved during World War II. It was used to produce flying bombs. Thousands of people in Britain and Belgium died as a result of V-1 and V-2 rocket attacks. The rockets were launched from Germany. The larger V-2 rocket had the ability to hit the United States. After the war, it became clear that the United States and the Soviet Union, allies in wartime, would become enemies in peacetime. So both countries employed German scientists to help them win the race to space. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. Laika orbited Earth for 7 days. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. He landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within 1/3 of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that a spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
On July 16, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet. That's looking good. Down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon.
More forward, drifting to the right a little. 30 seconds forward.
Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy.
Boy. Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It was hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that sense of history, that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.